Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in. My name is Vivian Roberts, and I'm the founder and artistic director of Aleph Contemporary. Today, it is my great pleasure to introduce our two speakers, Joe Baring and Miroslav Pomyshal. Joe Baring is a curator, consultant, and art speaker. She is the director of the Ingram Collection of Modern British and Contemporary Art, one of the UK's leading art collections. Jo has curated exhibitions at museums and public galleries across the country. A former director of Christie's UK, Jo is regularly requested to interview artists at museums and art fairs. She delivers lectures and takes part in panel discussions on all aspects of the art world. Her particular areas of expertise focus on 20th century and contemporary art, sculpture, arts philanthropy, and the art market. In spring 2020, she released her first podcast series, Sculpting Lives, supported by the Paul Mellon Centre for Studies in British Art, which was The Guardian's Art Podcast of the Week. Series 2 will be released later this year, and she is currently editing her first book on modern British art, which will be published in 2022. Miroslav Pomyshal is a British-Slovak artist, recently most active as a painter. He has exhibited both nationally and internationally in a number of private and public spaces. Pomyshal holds his MFA from Wimbledon College of Art and a BA Honours Art History from the Courtauld Institute of Art London. His work is found in numerous private and public collections, including the Ingram Collection UK and the Benetton Foundation Collection. The artist has had solo shows at three works with Anna Milenkovic Scarborough 2020, Kun Kellerman Fine Art Bratislava 2017, Flat Gallery Bratislava 2016, and Canal London also in 2016. Pomyshal has also exhibited in a number of museums, including the Institute of Contemporary Arts London, the World Museum Liverpool, the Lightbox in Woking, the Leopold Museum in Vienna, and the Bratislava City Gallery.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for joining this talk and conversation with the artist Miroslav Pomyshal. I'm delighted to be here with you today, Miroslav. Now, we actually go back quite a long way, don't we?
We do, Vivian, and thank you for introducing me, and thank you so much for having this talk with me, because it's been a couple of years since we haven't had this, and we've worked together before, and which is great.
Yeah. So basically, for those people that don't know, so we actually bought the Ingram Collection. So Chris Ingram and I came to your degree show at Wimbledon. And when was that? Back in 2013, 2014? 2014. So we're talking 7 years ago we've known each other. So 7 years ago, we came to the degree show and we were looking around. And I really actually remember still, and Chris and I still remember that moment of coming into the room and seeing your works there, and it was really a real jolt, and the kind of the power that they convey was really incredible, actually, and we were thrilled to see your work and learn about your work from that show. And since then we've got a number of works by you in the Ingram Collection, which we have shown at museums and galleries and institutions across the country. And I suppose the earliest one is a 2013 piece called Mismatch Couple. And then we've also got some paintings made in 2014, Bather 1 and Bather 2. So we can talk about those in a minute, actually, because I think they're a very nice way in to the works that you are making at the moment, the works that are in this show for Aleph Contemporary. And so let's start off. So since then, we've worked together on a number of things, and you've actually helped us with the Young Contemporary Talent Prize that we do. You've done talks with Chris. So it's lovely just to have this opportunity to discuss your latest work in detail.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. And as you quite rightly say, the new work is a little bit different. Some may think it's radically different. I don't think that, but there are differences and there are similarities with the work, and I think just to discuss what those are and to put that work into context of my previous work, I think is really special, because that doesn't happen often. I think it's quite a privilege to kind of see for you to see my work in that light and from that angle.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so if we start off with the earliest work that we've got in the Ingram collection, which is Mismatched Couple. Now, can you, I think there are going to be some images coming across screen, but for people who are listening to this on the podcast, I know it's quite an ask, but are you able to describe the work for us?
Okay, so having, you know, I teach history of art, and there's a whole visual analysis kind of like,
table,
scale, tone, color, shape, object, and I'm not going to go into that because that's that would probably be bore the listeners. But yeah, let's some of them are relevant. So the two, it's a diptych. They are 2 meters by 160 centimeters each, and they each are a painting of a figure, and so they're a couple. The figures are androgynous in terms of the sexuality, or I mean gender might be. I don't actually know which one is which, sorry. I think what their sex is. And I think that's why the name Mismatched Couple. It kind of relates also to obviously the mismatched couples of the Middle Ages and things. So they seem to be kind of dancing or floating. They seem to be composed of hard planes, almost pseudo-cubist, or again, Gothic planes. And they are floating on this flat orange background. And in the middle of the two is a carved, painted wooden pole. And that's it.
And actually, just trying to get a sense of the color, because the palette that you use is so incredibly strong and full of energy. And I think it's really important to convey that sense that you've created with those works, especially when we're thinking about the palette, when we come on to discussing the works in the current exhibition at Aleph Contemporary. There's a really great quote, actually, that I found from, I don't know if you were talking about the works at the time or a little bit later, but you're just saying that the individual colors, forms, and textures of the painting are all intended to induce a feeling of nostalgia in the viewer for a lost age when the importance or meaning of a work of art was emphatically not linked to technological advances, when the most radical artworks in the earlier 20th century were a rejection of Western society, technological innovation, and the resultant binding of freedoms.
Yeah, I actually think that quote is probably even more relevant to my new work. It's a lot more explicit in that. Absolutely. But I would add to that, because I can't really, argue with it because I said it. But I would add to that that nostalgia is emphasized by its that painting's similarity to a landscape with a sunset in it. And I was quite precise about trying to get that feeling through, because with a landscape and sunset, I always have this some feeling of nostalgia and a feeling of, you know, it's such a brief period of beauty when the land is clothed in this orange gold. And that color scheme, the dark green with the orange, was meant to suggest that and imply that, and it's why I think of those paintings as landscapes as well. So yeah, it was quite an intended effect. I'm not sure whether that was intended.
I'm interested in actually what you say when you're describing that landscape and you're describing the colors and the sun setting, and it potentially doesn't seem that like an English landscape to me. And how much of your childhood and the time spent growing up, impacts your work? So for listeners, can you tell us a little bit about your background, actually?
Yeah, so, I mean, this there could be, now you think about, I think about the sharpness of the angles, could relate to the mountains, you know, of Slovakia. So I'm from Slovakia, even though I was born and raised near Bratislava, and my parents studied and worked there, so it was close to the capital city. But both of my parents had a really close relationship to the wilderness and to the wild in Slovakia. And we used to go every weekend to the countryside, whether that would be like as tourists, whether it would be going to a chalet that we could use. It impressed itself upon me. But you know, I didn't grow up in a shepherd's hut, sadly. I would have loved to do that. I grew up in a communist country, a communist Czechoslovakia. And maybe that, and then I left, came to England when I was eight. And maybe that just even, you know, even sort of strengthened even more my, that kind of, that yearning, which I can't rub out for the idea of an idyllic life in the countryside or with the land. It's always going to be there, and yet inflected with all the, you know, with the moment in which we find ourselves, both sort of technologically, but also philosophically, art historically, et cetera, et cetera. So how do you make images that point to that eternal freedom or eternal hope or eternal yearning, while you tick all the boxes that you have to almost as a human being living today in this moment, which is probably the dilemma of every artist. Sorry, I just basically went.
I think it's absolutely fascinating, and really actually at the heart of that idea. So, you know, when you left at eight and came here, and yet you talk about that yearning. And I know that in conversations that we've had, your kind of Slovakia comes up a lot, and this idea of being in nature and returning there, and yet it's not overt in the painting. And yet I think it is there, you know, there it's in the shadows there. And especially, and it just seemed to me then when you were describing the sunset and the color and the kind of shimmering nature of sun over landscape in what are essentially figurative paintings, you know, of bodies in space, I find that quite interesting. And I suppose then if we link on to the other works that are in the Ingram collection that we've shown in museums and galleries across the UK, it's again they're figures in landscape, aren't they? And they're a year later.
Yeah, they are actually a lot more explicit in that sense. So while Mismatched Couple had an enigmatic, almost aggressive quality to them, the bathers were a lot more delicate. There are bathers, especially there are these kind of a small figure in the background actually bathing. There is that suggestion of actual of space, deep space and landscape, even though the figures themselves are still often are composed of abstract or, you know, almost you'd say post-industrial elements in some way, that have been almost reclaimed back by an organic form world. So, yeah.
And I'm reading some notes that I made around the time when we bought that work from you, those two works. And you said that the bathers one and two were made in response to a quote, long Slovakian summer. So interesting that is still, that those themes are still there. And inspired by a woodcut by a German expressionist painter and printmaker called Max Pechstein, who was expelled by the Nazis, which I find interesting. And also talking about exploring idealized or the kind of canonical depictions of similar scenes by artists such as Cezanne and Renoir. How much of, because obviously as a contemporary painter, I mean, there's a whole weight of art history, isn't there? So how much do you think you look back when making your paintings?
Some artists kind of have finally wrought answers that tick the right boxes. And but I have to be honest, I look back all the time and not just in my art, but almost in everything. I like to think that I'm like that, you know, angel of history looking back and flying forward. That's a very comforting thought for me. But many times I fear that I am fundamentally reactive, which I hope I'm not, or reactionary, which I hope I'm not, because I don't think I am. But anything that has a past for me, Joe, basically just is wrapped with so much more meaning for me. And I think it's because I kind of always imagine the journey it's been through, or the tribulations that even an object has been through, and how time and the elements and or human activity marked it. Coming back to art history, that's another thing is, there's a huge amount of writing, you know, or art criticism that talks about how it's problematic to to kind of look back at art history and not be critical. I've been critical very often, and yet the older I get, the more sort of swooning and softer and just appreciative I am of, as you say, Cezanne or Max Pechstein and the Expressionists and all of them, but seeing them all as, I'm kind of now seeing them all, and including world art now, just seeing it all as expression of one spirit almost, if before I kind of put those movements into boxes and said, oh, this movement is the right one. Russian constructivism is the right one because it had the correct political or philosophical ideals. I find now that the forms themselves perhaps are separated often and unconsciously kind of created by artists for whom the theory might be completely different. I mean, let's just talk about Monet and the Impressionists and how wrong they were. They thought they were being scientifically objective, and yet they weren't. But what came out of that movement was, you know, aesthetically kind of very, very strong work. So I look back at art history all the time, more than is healthy, basically.
I'm sure it's healthy. But what strikes me actually is hearing you talk like that and thinking about, you know, the artists that you've picked out and not defining them within their, you know, art historical terms, which we love to do, and the theories. But it strikes me that there's a certain level of maturity now in the way that you're approaching your work and almost, I suppose, in life as well, which is seeing painters who've gone before as struggling with the same sorts of issues and themes. You know, so I guess when you're kind of, you know, early 20s or mid 20s coming out of art school, they're kind of canonized, but then there is a realization that we're all human and we're all struggling with the same things, and particularly about expressing oneself in paint or on canvas or on paper. It's the same things that everyone is trying to do, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And you become a lot more forgiving to yourself and others when you realize, the older you get, just to being creative is very, very difficult. One, because real life starts to creep in, and that is just a monstrosity. But it, you know, it's there for everybody. Real life creeps, and I'm not going to bore you with the details, as you know. And then the other thing is that, as you say, you become more mature, and you maybe drop certain styles, certain ways of working, because you don't think that they're valid or interesting anymore. But sometimes they're not replaced immediately by another set. You know, sometimes by rejecting something you think is weak in your work doesn't automatically bring in a stronger element. And so it takes a longer time. And, you know, the graph of growth. And that's another thing, is I really wouldn't want to paint the same picture for the rest of my life. I can't do that. So I try to sort of plow my half acre as Piers the Plowman, but it's going slower and slower, and and that makes you more forgiving to yourself, to others, and to the expectations of what the other thing is. You see what's going on, you know, maybe in the market or another, or in society and politics, and you realize how little control you have over those things with your art, you know, by adding in political manifestos. Sometimes you do have power. I don't feel I have that power.
Interesting, actually, because some artists feel they have a kind of a social responsibility or a social, we're not saying not a social conscience, but a social responsibility or a political responsibility. Would you say then that your art is much more personal and much more of an expression of what you're thinking about, themes that you're reading, that kind of thing?
Yes and no. I think at the same time, I think social responsibility is a huge part of it, because but not, you know, I have to say something, it's for me, it's not political responsibility. I think social responsibility, the greatest one is freedom, and I think that is the only thing that I kind of hold, you know, I hold that as the highest value of freedom, and freedom of conscience and freedom of action, yeah, it's not at the moment any political kind of, you know, message or political change. I think I hope, or at the moment, the way I think, which goes perhaps against sort of some other other current ideas is I don't think everything is political. I think there is a world beyond politics that is more rewarding, is richer, it's more has more potentiality and brings people together. And I think, yeah, politics and the theory that every action, everything we say, everything we do is systemically political is not something that I wouldn't like to live in a world like that.
I think, and this moves in then to the works in The Stifled Cry, which I've just pulled up beside me to have a look at. But I think that there is a universality to an experience that you are describing in the works, that is a way in for us all. And particularly, obviously, after the kind of the year that we've had, some of those themes are more vital, I think. And so if we talk a little bit about the themes within the works in The Stifled Cry. So, I mean, some were made in the pandemic and some are a continuation of the work that you have been doing. So for people, there is going to be some images coming up on screen for people who are watching this as a video, but for people listening, can you describe the main motifs within this body of work?
Yeah, okay. So the main motifs are two types of inanimate objects. One would be stone objects, either fashioned into some kind of architectural element or not, or just sort of masonry. The other kind of object would be sort of old armor and weaponry, unidentifiable in terms of location, really, but discarded, you know, used and useless, really, in that sense. And some of my paintings are just collections of those collections of just the armor, sometimes just the stones. So they're almost kind of still lives, almost, but some are arranged to look almost like a figure. Some are teetering on stone ball. So there's that idea of light and heaviness. And all of them, particularly the stones, are scarred and punctured. And they look almost soft. And again, they look like flesh or meat. So then you have the those main leitmotifs. And there's one large work also in the show, which is a representative of another body of work. That I've got a few images of, which is the images of gates and portals. And so the one large work in the show is called Anti-Portal. And it's a big doorway made of stone and therefore kind of unopenable, but not set in any wall and just standing like a monolith in a landscape. Again, contains contradictions and paradoxes of matter and life, because it's bleeding a little bit as well. It's wounded, even though it's made of stone. So those are there are parallels in all the works, but some are a little bit different in terms of their content.
What strikes me is your interest and that you've picked stone as the material, because it seems to have this really timeless quality about it. And as you say yourself, you can't place anything, but you also can't date anything either, can you? Why was that important to you?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it's bound up with the sort of my idea of the act of painting, but bound up with some basic ideas like permanence. You know, the fact we will all die, and that an artist's fundamental inner drive is to seek some kind of permanence of his or her of one's of one's experience of life, basically. So it's about setting in, you know, images are really an attempt to make something permanent. And the stone, the idea of stone, is always sort of the most permanent, you know, inorganic thing. And yet it weathers itself and also it, in some ways, and often, very often, it starts to look a little bit like flesh. And then it's about the impermanence, really, even of the most permanent things. So yeah, that's why I've kind of, one of the reasons why I'm painting the stones.
And it outlasts us, doesn't it?
They outlast us. And in terms of what you said, they are unidentifiable in terms of which culture they've come from. That's again, hopefully gives it a bit more universality. I mean, some of them are, I've been having comments from artists or critics likening them to some of these Mesoamerican piles of stones. Obviously there's a classical Greco-Roman feel to many of them. There's a like a Viking or sort of, prehistoric or Dark Ages feel to them. And that's another whole strand, which is that relationship to Dark Ages and fantasy art as well, with its exaggeration of form.
I'm really drawn to that idea of pulling back into those images about sculpture and humans kind of building piles of stone and the kind of the importance of that and the symbolic nature of that, the kind of the totems that people have been creating for almost millennia, really kind of wanting to affect the environment in which we experience life. What is also fascinating about the works is that you say they hint at humanity. So there's nothing in there. There's no human presence, but there are suggestions of human presence. So there are the kind of, there's the helmet, and as you say, there's some blood, or the words that you use, like, the stones are scarred, and all that kind of thing suggests human participation and presence, but not depicted. So you'd moved on from the figure, the body, to removing the body. How did that process happen?
I think basically, for me, the lack of human presence invites contemplation rather than a confrontation with it. Rather than being drawn into an immediate narrative, there are obviously traces of human activity in a lot of my paintings, but it invites more contemplation. There's a stillness there, and I think that is the fundamental reason why I left the human form, the figure, and try to reconstruct it in a more contemplative or still way. And as I told you, I thought of the figurative work that are in your collection as landscapes in some ways, and I think of these works almost as some of them as figures, because they act like bodies sometimes, because they get punctured and they get scarred and they look like they've been, like they react to trauma in some way. And yet that permanence of the stones, the organic quality, is somehow comforting as well at the same time.
Mm. And what's also interesting about them is that it hints about, you talk about the importance of painting to you, and actually the idea of painting something, so the stones are heavy, they're full of texture, they are, they last for sometimes centuries, and yet you are kind of depicting them as paint on canvas. So there's that interplay as well, isn't there? Kind of you as the painter trying to create something, the idea of something which also then doesn't exist.
Absolutely, and that also is married into the idea of physicality. So, as painting today, it's been derided for decades, and it will be derided again and again. And some corners you hear that painting is only valid while it devours or sponges off technology. So, post digital painting or painting that takes takes the cue from technology. Well, so much of my work is taken from the internet, but it doesn't mean it has to. It has to kind of be its constant handmaiden. And I think a lot more, people are realizing just how important the physical world is, and it's been so for me. And so this is the idea of physicality of paint as a real physical thick medium that is, however, there to create an illusion of something, to paint an image that contains objects. There's a metaphor there with the actual subject matter and the content of the work, the actual subject matter of heavy stones that are actually vulnerable or soft forms that bleed or look massive but are clearly inflated and therefore appear like balloons in some ways. And that again goes to the cartoon effect. Sasha, I think, really focused on that cartoon idea of it, which is part of it. It's not, you know, it's not the major part of it, but there is that as well. So yeah, the subject matter is a metaphor almost for the painting process itself.
And the thing that really strikes me within it is this idea of decay and the impossibility of us as humans, as painters, you know, trying to build these permanent structures, trying to create, and yet it's the inevitable of decline and decay across civilizations, but also within our own bodies as well.
Yeah. So that's again something, you know, that I always found. I mean, I remember, I find it so strange to watch films about, you know, set in, I don't know, wherever, LA or London police or thrillers and things, and or films about bankers, and they're all wearing these crisp suits and white shirts and perfect hairstyles and everything's perfect. But I can't stop imagining the sort of processes of physical decay happening underneath that. And that's the reality. It's always going to be there, you know, morbidly. In Czechoslovakia or in former communist countries, you have humongous ferro-concrete monuments to the revolution or to certain kinds of political resistance during the Second World War, let's say. But when you look at them now, there are bits falling off and there's obviously no money to restore them. And even things that were meant to look super futuristic and, you know, futuristic, not just in a sense of, you know, Tesla, the futurism of communism was an all-encompassing project where hundreds of millions of people, nations, participated. And so if, you know, these monuments are pretty impressive. And yet the moment while there's one chip that falls off it, I think for me, the entire thing becomes an illusion. And I think maybe that's another driver of these works and why I feel compelled to make these things imperfect. The moment something is imperfect, to an almost extreme degree, to me, that makes it pleasant. That makes it a comfortable viewing experience because I can see that nothing more can go wrong, and it satisfies that fear of entropy.
And also that idea of the kind of humans always trying, the kind of the victory of will, trying and failing for the victory of will over flesh.
Yeah, the daily, you know, our daily routine. You know, in fact, I got this laptop to work for this talk because there's some, you know, my antivirus isn't working properly or whatever, and it's just this, it's an endless delimitation of chaos from breaching into our lives on a daily basis just by brushing your teeth. That's fundamentally what you're doing, is keeping death, decay at death's, at the door. And I just wonder what the purpose of that is, and there must be a purpose. That's one of the reasons also kind of I enjoy the content of these works, because there's that medievalist side to it, which all of a sudden opens up, you know, a new portal really to the spiritual realm, or to at least the promise of a spiritual life.
Well, let's go into that then. So you have a real interest in medievalism, don't you?
I do, yeah, I do. I did my undergraduate thesis on a medieval manuscript. And since then, and I translated a few art history books as well, many on the Middle Ages. And I do have a big interest in medievalism, which is different from the Middle Ages. It's the way that subsequent people and cultures look on at the Middle Ages, because there's the idea that you can't really understand the Middle Ages from our point of view anyway.
What you said about that idea of the spiritual realm, I want to explore a bit more, because although we've talked about kind of entropy and decay and ruins and you signpointing the way to us, the works in this exhibition are in no way depressing. You know, I don't find them depressing. I don't find them negative in a way. I find them in a way very uplifting and kind of, I'm trying to think of the right word, but just a confirmation of our shared human endeavor, you know, and potentially then that is linked to that spiritual realm or the idea of spiritualism that you were talking about linked to medievalism.
Yeah, definitely. I do. I also think these paintings are beautiful to me, and I take joy in them. I'm happy to see them. I think they're very positive images. They're the images I need to paint. But what was I going to say about the spiritual side of them? Painting itself is, that's another thing with this physicality and its creation of illusion, is an act of going beyond itself. Painting itself is a spiritual activity by its very definition, because it points to something else, or it transforms matter into something else. That's another really compelling, interesting idea for me. And I think there's a parallel again, the metaphor for the image of the heavy built monastery, or the heavy, you know, the castle of God, or the heavenly gates, all those images that are built of massive stones and yet are there to protect the soul or to welcome the soul from danger, has a fundamentally spiritual message or objective. And it's what I'm interested in medievalism, is that idea of contradiction between the heaviness and actually what it's meant to point to, or what it's meant to suggest or protect or help in achieving.
So really, painting is symbolically and metaphorically a really good mode of expression for this subject matter. And also is that idea that we've talked about, which is our kind of mission or our desire to go beyond the limits of physical matter in order to create more, and making it a portal almost into a different reality or a way in. And I suppose, again, that's, if we talk potentially then just quickly, because I know we're about to run out of time, but some of these specific works in the show, and that portal idea links us on to anti-portal. So yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, that was a really nice way of you putting it. So I can't kind of improve on it. But the anti-portal itself, links to all of this, because it's painted with thick paint. It's made up of these incredibly large blocks that at the same time look very soft, like they've been eaten up and softened and rounded by the weather. They're also cracked, they're scarred, they've got a kind of bleeding as well. And it's an actual doorway. So it has hinges, but the doorway also has a triangular window looking like a wall, and it's just standing there. And there's no wall that it attaches to. And there's just this, you know, dark sky with lightning bolts surrounding it. And so just by the fact of how it's painted and what it's showing, it already talks about the heaviness, lightness, the spirit and the matter. But the fact that it's a, you know, it's an anti-portal, it's a portal that doesn't do its job, doesn't work, talks more about the choice of the viewer or myself. But it goes into the choices that we make or we stop ourselves from making in today's world. Sometimes there are doors that are not even there, that are there because you put them there. And there's a portal here that you could easily walk around, but you won't. You'll just stand there transfixed by it and not go forward. And I think that's another you know, inflection or angle that this work has as well, is the idea sometimes of the portals as being portals to another realm or another choice. And that's not, you know, it's not limited to life on this earth necessarily either. I think it's quite interesting to think whether there is something beyond death, and we spend time try not to think about it because, or dismiss it lightly, because life is good at the moment. But then it hasn't been very good recently. And I don't know. What I'm saying is that there's an element here that's not just of worldly choices.
And I think that gets to the heart of actually the works within the show, is that there's the meanings are so multi-layered, and that what we talked about earlier, that idea of universality of human experience. So everyone can look at these works, which are objectively, aesthetically beautiful works of art. You know, they're kind of beautiful objects in their own right. And then within that, there are those different themes. And particularly, I think we will relate to that idea that we create our own limits. You know, those kind of metaphorical barriers that we put around our own experiences to stay comfortable or refusing to make ourselves uncomfortable. You also guide the way for us, don't you, slightly in your choice of titles?
Yeah, a little bit. Which one should we talk about?
Well, I love the one that's inspired by the Renaissance woodcut. Can we talk about the bees? I love that.
Yeah, let's talk about the bees. So I've made a few pictures. Where there's this collection of stones and there's a helmet on top, or sometimes there's just a helmet, and there's bees buzzing around the helmet, and the title is Ex Bello Pax, which is Latin for "From war comes peace," and the inspiration was an old Renaissance woodcut that actually it has its roots in the Middle Ages as an emblem. So in the Renaissance, then there were these scholars who collected emblems and put them in books. And one of them is this Ex Bello Pax, which is a woodcut of a helmet that has been cast away because war has ended and bees have moved in to make a beehive out of that helmet. And I just think it is. Literally the best kind of emblem for my work, and I've been thinking about incorporating it for so long, years and years and years actually, and I've never done it, and I thought, well, let's give it a go. And I think the bees still look a little bit too much like flies to me sometimes when I look at it from the wrong angle, because of the general decay, because of the sort of what is expected of my work, but they're actually bees, and that gives it a It puts everything on its head, of course. It gives it totally new meaning.
Exactly. It's about life and creation, yeah. Not flies buzzing around the dead, rotting flesh. Again, you have to look closely to get in, which is fabulous. I could talk to you all day. Before we go, I just want to touch on your choice of palette for this exhibition. It's different to the works that we've got in the Ingram collection. It's earthier, is it? Can you tell us a little bit about that choice of palette and how you moved into that?
Yeah, so at the Ingram collection, actually, I try to keep my colours very, very separate, just sort of technically. And the figures were purely earth colours. It's just ochres, umbers, greens, but they were not mixed with greys. So there's no tones, really. It was just kind of pure colour. And the orange was a pure colour. But more and more, I've started... And it was very layered. Do you remember? It was very, very layered, almost like Van Gogh, kind of on turbo mode. But with this, I'm still using a lot of earth colors. Of course, I mix in a few sort of madders and crimsons and other transparent hues as well into the work, but predominantly earth colors, but they are being modified by a lot of grays. And I think that gives it a little bit of a muted palette, but also quite a lot more, a little bit more subtlety in the individual strokes. So rather than in the old works, every color and line was individually mixed on the palette before it was applied, with these paintings, they're not entirely mixed. There's what I do is I kind of, that, you know, I have it, it's an art, isn't it, of course, but it's all about the amounts of different colors that you put on the brush, and they kind of mix by themselves onto the canvas, but you know, you kind of need to have a bit of experience to know exactly what the proportions are, but it gives it that earthy tactile feel.
It really creates that certain mood, doesn't it, within the exhibition. It's fabulous. There is so, I mean, I think that the key thing about your work is there's so much depth, there's so much to discuss, you know, just the choice of colours, the motifs, the titles, the kind of the themes. There's huge, big themes, but also love that idea. We haven't even discussed the kind of your interest in, you know, history and literature, all that kind of thing. It's just fantastic. So for people who are watching and listening, do have a look at Mirosław's works. They are really incredible contemporary paintings. Thank you so much for your time today. It's been an absolute joy to talk to you.
Thank you, Jo. Likewise, and just hope to see you soon in real life as well.
In real life, I know. Hopefully, yeah. Fingers crossed.
Thank you.